Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The birth and development of the American police can be traced to a multitude of historical, legal, and political economic conditions. The institution of slavery and the control of minorities, however, were two of the more formidable historic features of American society shaping early policing. Slave patrols and night watches, which later became modern police departments, were both designed to control the behaviors of minorities. Slave patrols helped to maintain the economic order and to assist the wealthy landowners in recovering and punishing slaves who essentially were considered property.
The headlines: the U.S. imposes sanctions against Iran over alleged drone deliveries to Russia for use in the Ukraine war. A railway strike in the UK enters its last day as the government mulls action to make it harder for key workers to walk out. And the US House of Representatives finally names a new speaker after repeated failures unseen in over a century. Welcome. Our top story: the U.S. has imposed the fresh sanctions on Iran, this time targeting suppliers of drones that Washington claims Russia has been using in the war in Ukraine. The sanctions targeted six executives and board members of the Quds Aviation Industries. The U.S. Treasury Department described the industries as a key Iranian defense manufacturer responsible for designing and producing drones. The sanctions also targeted the director of Iran's Aerospace Industries Organization. The measures freeze any U.S.-based assets of those targeted individuals and ban Americans from dealing with them. Iran has denied allegations that it has provided Russia with drones to be used in the Ukraine war. Tehran says it did send the drones to Russia, but that was before the start of the war in February. Moscow has also denied using Iranian drones in Ukraine. Elsewhere, Israel's new cabinet is already stepping up pressure against Palestinians, including those it holds in prison. Tel Aviv is angry over the Palestinians' appeal at the International Court of Justice. The regime says it will impose a moratorium on some Palestinian construction and place financial and political sanctions against the Palestinian Authority. Israel says the measures are a response to the PA's decision to wage political and legal war against Israel. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has reacted to the Israeli announcement, saying the measures won't block the nation's efforts to end Israeli occupation. Meanwhile, an Israeli minister has paid a visit to an Israeli prison, saying he aims to ensure Palestinian prisoners' conditions will not improve. Hamas has slammed the visit, calling the plans against Palestinian detainees an unprecedented criminal act.
The visit by the minister of the fascist Israeli regime, Itamar Ben-Gvir, to Nafha prison with the aim of harassing the prisoners is an unprecedented criminal act against them.
Hamas stressed that what the Israeli regime is planning is a dangerous escalation. It said the Palestinian people will not stand idly by while the Israeli forces enforce such schemes. The newly formed Israeli cabinet is headed by Benjamin Netanyahu and involves members of extremist Israeli parties. This cabinet is widely viewed as the most far-right in the regime's history. The new measures come after months of Israeli violence against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank that has been unprecedented in nearly 20 years. Regime forces killed more than 220 Palestinians in 2022. The U.S. has announced a new military aid package for Ukraine worth over $3 billion this time. The White House says the package is expected to include MRAP armored personnel carriers and self-propelled howitzers. The U.S. is also planning to provide Ukraine with Bradley armored vehicles. This as Germany says it plans to send 40 Marder armored fighting vehicles to Ukraine as part of a new phase of Western military support for Kiev.
Regarding the Marders, we want to send a battalion which consists of roughly 40 vehicles. Those 40 vehicles should be ready in the first quarter, still to then be handed over to Ukraine. Experts are saying the training will take about 8 weeks and the training will take place in Germany beforehand.
The announcement was made following a phone call between German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and US President Joe Biden. Germany says a Patriot anti-aircraft missile system from Army stocks is also to be delivered to Ukraine in the first quarter of this year. And France, meanwhile, said it was arranging for the delivery of tanks to Ukraine. Russia says the West's military support for Ukraine will only prolong the war and increase the suffering of its people. It's time now for our news review segment, where we take a look at one of our stories in a little bit more detail. A strike by UK railway workers has entered its fifth and final day, with thousands of signalers and train crew walking out. Only about one in five trains across the country is running on Saturday. Passengers have already been advised to avoid taking trains, and union leaders are due to meet the rail minister on Monday to try and resolve a dispute over pay. The workers want better pay and working conditions at the time when inflation has soared to record levels in the UK. The action is the latest in strikes in the past months over the same issue, involving different sectors from nurses to teachers. The government is now planning to introduce a new law that would make it harder for key workers to strike. The legislation forces them to maintain a basic level of service during strike time or face dismissal. For more on that, we're joined by Robert Carter, our correspondent in the British capital, London. And we also have John Ross, a senior fellow at the Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies and former economic advisor to London Mayor. Welcome. So, Robert, if I start with you, what's the latest? Of course, it's not just the railways. We can't list all the sectors that have gone on strike because we'll be here literally until the middle of next week.
Yes, sure. There are, of course, a lot of strike action taking place here in the UK. It's major economic turbulence that's going on. And, of course, unions are trying to use this opportunity to try and pressure the government to get better conditions. The government, of course, is not backing down in terms of seemingly giving in to many or any of their demands, which is essentially they want higher pay, better pay standards, that kind of thing, to defeat inflation and so on. But basically, the government is now introducing this new measure, these new laws, which again is putting them in a very awkward position where they're essentially taking away rights of unions to strike and their workers to strike. And this, of course, is something which brings into question the nature of Britain's democracy right now. Because, of course, workers' rights and ability to strike and to fight for better working conditions is one of the pillars of a thriving democracy. And actually, in the UK, you find the government is currently trying to erode those freedoms away. The government is saying, however, that they have to make a choice here because they can't afford to increase everyone's pay, and they have to keep important services like the ambulance, nurses at work in order to stop unnecessary loss of life. But again, this is not being well received by members of the public and also by union bosses themselves, who have been completely condemning the government outright as basically acting in a kind of dictatorial fashion, or taking the country in a way that would resemble more of a dictatorship, which perhaps one day will ultimately ban unions and workers' ability to strike. That's the kind of thing that's being speculated now, and that's the direction, the slippery slope that Britain finds itself in. But the opposition Labour Party have decided that they will fight against this, even though Labour themselves have also been condemned for compromising on their traditional values of standing up for workers' rights. Here it seems that the government has gone too far and Labour has decided they'll take a stand.
Right, John, what's your take on that? So the government, not just Rishi Sunak, all the Tory PMs that have used that revolving door in Downing Street over the past decade or so, is trying its best to make it harder for public workers to protest in the form of taking strike action, despite there being record inflation levels.
Well, I mean, what the government's basically introducing is a charter for slavery. I mean, let's be quite clear what's involved. They're going to attempt to compel people to work when they don't want to. I mean, because it's not even, I mean, I'm against bringing in, replacing workers on the job by ununionized scab labor, etc. But you can't even do this in many of these jobs because they're highly skilled. You can't take somebody off the street or out of the army and get them to drive a train. The system will be inundated with train crashes, during the first day. An ambulance worker is not just somebody who drives an ambulance. Most of them are paramedics. You can't take somebody who's got no medical training and send them to somebody who may be suffering a heart attack. These people, you're not even replacing labor. You are compelling people to work when they don't want to work. That is to say, the best way to characterize this is a charter for slavery. I mean, it shows the sort of what you might call the decline of Britain, because we haven't had to have such measures, for 100 years. I mean, the people who are going on strike now are absolutely not sort of militant extremists. I mean, the Royal College of Nursing, for example, has never had a strike in its entire 100-year history before the present time. And very unlikely group of people have been on strike. For example, criminal barristers, who certainly can't be considered a hotbed of left-wing extremists. The population is suffering greatly because of the policies of the government, and they've taken action by this in the normal way by strike. And what the government's compelled to introduce, and say, a charter for slavery. That's what it's attempting to do.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much indeed for that. Let me thank our guests for their contribution. Robert Carter is our correspondent in London, and John Ross is a senior fellow at the Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies and former economic advisor to the London mayor, also from the British capital, London. Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for that. And that brings an end to another edition of the News Review. Right, moving on now. The race is just over. The US House of Representatives finally elects a new speaker. After 15 rounds of voting this week, Kevin McCarthy from California won the post after defeats over 4 days caused by Republican infighting. A group of 20 hardline Republicans were against McCarthy. They had cited their lack of trust on him over political issues with President Joe Biden and the Democratic-held Senate. McCarthy gave concessions to be able to get the post. He's succeeding Democrat Nancy Pelosi. Republicans took control of the U.S. House in November elections. The latest race to name a new speaker was the longest in 160 years. And Biden has congratulated McCarthy and says he's ready to work with the Republicans. The latest saga at the U.S. House was overshadowed by the third anniversary of the January 6th storming of the Capitol by supporters of former President Donald Trump.
The 2-year anniversary of the election integrity protest, which burst into Congress on January 6, 2020, has been overshadowed by Congress's historic failure to select the third most important post in the country, the Speaker of the House of Representatives. After more than a dozen votes, mainstream Republican Kevin McCarthy finally won a majority, ending the total paralysis of the new Congress. However, the embarrassing stalemate was the worst of its kind since before the American Civil War.
Both of them just show how American politics is dominated by spectacle and political theater, while Americans who are suffering through terrible economic hardship right now and are politically polarized are just sitting on the sidelines while all this plays out.
As the speaker chaos continued, Democrats demanded attention for 2020, while Republican lawmakers largely ignored the anniversary. The stark difference isn't surprising. Polls have long shown that 35% of the country still calls the events of January 6th a legitimate protest, while 50% still calls it an insurrection. The subsequent January 6th committee to investigate the incident was either branded a political show trial and witch hunt or a necessary defense of American-style democracy.
It should have been a bipartisan inquiry, a serious one, into what was, you know, supposedly this, you know, vast constitutional violation by Trump and his campaign and his administration, and it's just become this endless commercial for the Democratic Party, which is totally bankrupt. And 2 years later, they're still using it to, you know, try and get themselves elected.
While Washington is repeatedly faulted for encouraging protests in other countries, almost 200 January 6th protesters have been sentenced to prison terms. Seemingly every participant has been publicly hunted down, which may serve as a chilling effect which forestalls future protests. Has Washington's response to the controversial events of January 6, 2020 reduced conflict, division, and disunity? We cannot ask Congress, because just like 2 years ago, they cannot meet in peace. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Peruvians hit the streets again, demanding the resignation of President Dina Boluarte, who took over from her ousted predecessor, Pedro Castillo, in December. Protesters blocked roads, threw stones, and burnt tires in several cities. In some places, police fired tear gas to disperse the crowd that was trying to barricade the main routes. Peru has been in turmoil ever since Castillo was removed from office and arrested for attempting to dissolve Congress to avoid an impeachment. He's now in pre-trial detention over charges of rebellion and conspiracy. Former Vice President Boluarte assumed power shortly after Castillo's removal. She has already rescheduled general elections to minimize public anger. Almost 24 people have been killed in protests since last month. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
The birth and development of the American police can be traced to a multitude of historical, legal, and political economic conditions. The institution of slavery and the control of minorities, however, were two of the more formidable historic features of American society shaping early policing. Slave patrols and night watches, which later became modern police departments, were both designed to control the behaviors of minorities. Slave patrols helped to maintain the economic order and to assist the wealthy landowners in recovering and punishing slaves who essentially were considered property. Though many years have passed from the abolishment of slavery, police brutality is the enduring legacy of slavery in the U.S. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. In response to the sustained and increasingly visible violence against black communities in the U.S., the Black Lives Matter movement took shape. The movement campaigns against police violence and systematic racism towards African Americans. People from all walks of life in the Black Lives Matter campaign regularly protest police killings of black people and broader issues of racial profiling, police brutality, and racial inequality in the United States criminal justice system. Stay with us as this documentary talks to activists, specialists, and family members of police brutality victims to depict the true picture of systematic injustice and racism in the heart of American society. Don't go away. Here's the first part.
Garner went unconscious.
The cops used a chokehold that allegedly led to Eric Garner's death.
Me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop wondering why. I was screaming at the TV.
This death not being called a homicide.
In a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes.
A Staten Island grand jury has decided not to indict an NYPD officer in the death of a man on Staten Island.
They said that they are going to be out here every night marching until they get an indictment in the death of Eric Garner. There is just as much anger out here tonight, just as much passion.
You're seeing these police officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard. The protesters are basically right in their faces.
Protesters in Minneapolis have attempted to shut down the city's airport this afternoon. The group representing the Black Lives Matter movement blocked two roads outside a terminal before state police ordered the group to disperse. Back to the situation in downtown Los Angeles, looks like protesters have moved now onto the 101 freeway in downtown. Earlier in the day, organizers of the group promised that a demonstration involving hundreds of protesters would shut down the Mall of America.
You know, I don't remember the kind of life before what's going on. Like, you know, all of my activities have to do with basically what we call the revolution. You kind of just dive in it head first. It's like, so you can't stop. And, you know, I feel like If I stop this time, I can no longer complain about anyone that's murdered unarmed after, you know, Akai Gurley and Eric Gardner and Mike Brown. So I have to keep going with this. Martin Luther King, I mean, he was in the movement for 13 years before he was assassinated. So it's not something that's going to be overnight. The significance to me of Black Lives Matter is that it's something that's nationwide. It's not just a New York problem, it's a New Jersey problem, it's across the United States. And, you know, Black Lives Matter is basically calling attention that, hey, you know, you say that all lives matter, and yes, all lives matter, but Black lives aren't mattering right now. So that's what we're trying to let you guys know is, hey, you know, hi, Black Lives Matter. You know, we're being kind of hunted, and it's a little bit of a pattern. At first, you know, people could say maybe it was a coincidence, but now it's just a pattern. And it's almost like every year there's some, you know, publicly broadcasted, you know, murder of an unarmed African-American or brown person.
Well, I moved to New York in November for work. I'm an attorney. I work in banking and financial compliance, but I've always been really active outside of work in, like, activists and social justice missions. And I don't think people want to confront the issue that there's an issue with our system, that our police, not all of them, but there are some within those ranks, are brutalizing and terrorizing American citizens. And so I believe in our Constitution. I do believe in our criminal justice system. I think it, you know, it has the potential to be a great system, but the corruption within it and the bias within it makes it a very dangerous system for Black and brown people.
Our justice system is not corrupt. It's just very decentralized in comparison to other democratic countries. And when it's decentralized, it's based on a variety of standards for people who are part of the system. And some of the standards are not as high as we would like them to see. And then people paint with a very broad brush, extrapolating from one jurisdiction to another. Definitely we have race issues in our society, not just in the United States, in many other countries. Police officers are recruited from the society and from the community. So there's no doubt in my mind that some of the officers have various biases.
On February 26, 2012, in Sanford, Florida, Trayvon Martin, an unarmed 17-year-old high school student coming home from a nearby convenience store, was fatally shot by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch captain. Martin died from a single gunshot wound to the chest. When police arrived at the scene, Zimmerman admitted that he shot Martin, but he claimed he had acted in self-defense. No charges were initially brought against Zimmerman. It was not until the shooting garnered national attention that Zimmerman was charged in connection with Martin's death. In July 2013, a jury acquitted Zimmerman of all charges. Upon the not guilty verdict, there were protests nationwide in more than 100 cities. President Obama said that he identified with the boy. Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago.
Why was it that Trayvon tended to fizzle out? One reason was because he got all of that rage that was finally manifest, but it was geared toward what? Laws, stand your ground. It wasn't geared toward the powers that be. It wasn't geared toward the federal government. It wasn't geared toward the White House. It was geared toward state laws. Well, why is that so? Well, that's exactly what the powers that be wanted it to be. You see, the president's office, what did he do? He sent his own extension, who was Sharpton. And Sharpton gives a great speech, and it's all about state laws rather than police going to jail. Everybody knows that you're not going to change arbitrary police power until policemen start going to jail. Why is it that in the last 7 years you haven't had one policeman go to jail? It's the same reason why you haven't had one Wall Street executive go to jail. Because the government doesn't want them to go to jail. The government don't want to put power in that direction to go to jail. You can rest be assured, if you had a massive network of poor people engaged in gangster activity like Wall Street did with market manipulation and insider trading, those folk going to get caught and go to jail. You can rest be assured that the police were killing well-to-do white folk Some policemen are going to jail. It's a priority. It's not a priority of the U.S. government to send policemen to jail, not until it starts affecting them in the way it already affects many of us. And you see, some of us believe that the life of a poor black person, a poor blind person, has exactly the same value as that of a well-to-do white or well-to-do black or anybody else of the upper class.
We did have officers jailed for excessive force, especially in we had a case, an infamous case in Charleston in South Carolina, when the officer shot an individual in his back, and he was actually, he's right now in prison. The judicial system is not designed to avoid prosecution of police officers, but because the standard is a standard of discretion of the individual police officer, and the standard is based on, again, individual perceptions of the situations, it appears sometimes that there is injustice because we look at this behavior in hindsight, and for us it appears as excessive, but for the officer at the given moment on the street it wasn't excessive, and the jurors frequently accept the word of the officer.
There is growing outrage tonight after an unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri.
There was a struggle, and one of the men pushed the officer into his car.
Within the police car, there was a struggle over the officer's weapon. There was at least one shot fired within the car.
The struggle spilled out onto the street where Brown, whom investigators say was not armed, was fatally shot.
Police have shot this man for no reason.
A little more than a year later, Michael Brown, an 18-year-old unarmed African-American man, was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri, a northern suburb of St. Louis. Brown, who had stolen several packages of cigarillos from a nearby convenience store shortly before the shooting, was confronted by 28-year-old Darren Wilson, a white Ferguson police officer. The disputed circumstances of the Brown shooting sparked unrest in the majority black city, and protests erupted. The events received considerable attention in the U.S. and elsewhere, and generated a vigorous debate about the relationship between law enforcement and African Americans, as well as the use of force by police in Missouri and across the nation.
In Ferguson, Michael Brown case, it's the word of the police officer, and we don't have any footage. We don't have the only footage that we have is what happened before at the convenience store. The footage at the convenience store is not very, you know, positive in terms of how I look at this. It shows somebody who is acting very aggressively within the convenience store, and it gives me an indication that there was some level of violence that was displayed.
The Black Lives Matter movement focuses primarily on the experience of black men and has shaped the conversation about police brutality, where it occurs, and how it's addressed. But black women are also being killed, assaulted, and victimized by police. Women are often targeted in the same way as men, through shootings, police stops, and racial profiling. A growing number of Black Lives Matter activists, including the women behind the original hashtag, have been refocusing attention on how African American women and other marginalized communities are treated by the police. They're not only highlighting the impact racial discrimination has on their communities, but articulating why a movement for racial justice must be inclusive. Women have been at the forefront of organizing marches, die-ins, protests, and various initiatives to have their voices heard. Young African American women have been playing a central role.
Cigarettes,
let's arrest him. Let's have him go before a jury of his peers,
yeah.
And let's use the system the way it's supposed to be used. Cops are not supposed to be the judge, jury, and executioner. That's the end of the story,
Really. Like, say hypothetically, one or two of these shootings are justified.
they don't even give us that opportunity to think, you know, critically about it, because regardless of what happens with the situation, they're not held accountable, which is the part that bothers me the most. It's like, regardless of what's happening, if it's a little boy, unarmed, kid sleeping, a grown man, you know, selling cigarettes, no matter what the police does to them, they're not being held accountable for it.
And there's no data. That's another big issue that I think when we have the demands, I mean, because I like Esther's, her list of demands, they kind of just echo what everyone's kind of feeling in the movement, but there needs to be data, because why can't we find any, you know, data about how many police-involved shootings, how many fatalities, how many were armed, how many weren't armed? We need that kind of information.
That's a serious issue. I think we need to really capitalize on, like, the momentum that we have here.
Yeah.
And definitely use that to engage the young people, because those are the people who are going to make a change. And that's why we have to do this at a local level. You know what I'm saying? We have to focus locally. And I think, like, our demonstrations, the vigil being one of them, is a good way to do that. You know what I'm saying? Just re-engage people at a local level and then help them to see that we can make change. So thank you guys, as always, for going out and supporting Erica night after night. I mean, we do that weekly, on a weekly basis, two nights a week. So when one of us can't get there, I appreciate that somebody is there to support her. Yeah.
She needs that consistency.
Absolutely.
On July 17th, 2014, almost 1 year after George Zimmerman was acquitted in connection with the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, Eric Gardner, a 43-year-old father of six, died of a heart attack while in police custody. He was being arrested when a New York Police Department officer, Daniel Pantaleo, put Gardner in a chokehold. Gardner was arrested on a Staten Island street corner on suspicion of selling untaxed cigarettes. After Gardner resisted being arrested, Pantaleo pulled Gardner to the ground by the neck and placed him into a fatal chokehold. In a cell phone video taken by a passerby, Gardner, who suffered from chronic asthma and heart problems, repeatedly says, "I can't breathe," 11 times in total. This video has been viewed more than 2.5 million times. A grand jury declined to indict Officer Pantaleo, and he remains with the NYPD.
On July 17th, my father was out here just like another regular day, you know, talking with his friends. That day, I was at work. I worked in Long Island at that time. I got a call from my mom. I was talking to my mom. And then about 5-10 minutes after I got off the phone with my mom, my sister calls, and she's like, you know, she don't know what's going on. She's all, my mom is, you know, all hysterical, crying. She don't know what's going on. They just said, "Dad, just stop breathing." So she started calling, you know, the hospital, trying to figure out what was going on. We couldn't get no information in from the phone. They called her and told her, you know, that it was something that went down and my dad stopped breathing. You know, she didn't know that it had anything to do with the cops until she got to the hospital. And so by the time we came to Staten Island, me, my aunt, and my cousins, you know, we drove past this part of where it happened, and we seen a whole bunch of news vans and yellow tape, and we still didn't know what was going on. So we got to my grandmother's house, and that's when a reporter from the Daily News was there, and he told us, you know, it was a confrontation with the cops, and there's a video, and would you guys like to see it before it goes out on the internet, and would you give us permission to let it go out? And me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop. Like, I couldn't stop wondering why, you know. I was screaming at the TV, because, you know, in a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being
killed, murdered right before our eyes, and it was just horrible for us to see. I mean, we couldn't go into the living room and describe what we seen on the TV, on the computer to our grandparents or to my mother, because it was so horrible. Like, I was sick that day. I mean, I just, you know, my whole body, it was just, like, shaky. It was, I just couldn't believe. And then when me and my aunt was driving back to Brooklyn, we stopped over here after all the cops left and everything. And people noticed me. I never been to Staten Island like that. Like, I stayed in Brooklyn. But my father used to talk a lot about me and his granddaughter. And when they noticed my face, that I looked like my dad, you know, the love was just pouring out. You know, people was telling me their versions of the story. And it was just like, wow, I still can't believe this happened.
Gardner case is problematic in the sense that experts in martial arts and some other people who specialize in takedowns of individuals believe that this was more of a takedown than a chokehold. Part of the problem is patrol guide or operating procedures, standard operating procedures of NYPD that were very broad. They were changing now. The use of force procedures have been changed since Eric Gardner case.
A recent study on children, published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, found that black boys as young as 10 are more likely to be mistaken as being older, be thought of as guilty of possible crimes, and face police violence if accused of a crime. According to a ProPublica analysis of federally collected data on fatal police shootings, young black males were 21 times more likely to have been shot dead by police than their white counterparts. The 1,217 deadly police shootings from 2010 to 2012 captured in the federal data show that black males, ages 15 to 19, died at the hands of police at a rate of 31.17 per million. White males in the same age range were killed at a rate of just 1.47 per million.
Tonight, it was a case that sparked outrage across the nation and heartbreak here in Cleveland. 12-year-old Tamir Rice playing with a gun outside a rec center. The gun turned out to be fake, and he was shot to death by a rookie police officer who says that he thought it was real. Now the Cuyahoga County prosecutor has released three brand new reports on this shooting just within the past few hours. One is from the Highway Patrol. The other two are from experts asked to weigh in on this case months ago. They both found that the officer was justified. So who are these experts and how did they reach this decision?
In November 2014, 12-year-old Tamir Rice was shot and killed by a police officer in Cleveland, Ohio. Two officers, Timothy Lohman and Frank Garnback, were responding to a 911 call reporting that a man in a neighborhood park was walking around with what was described as probably a fake gun. Just 1.5 seconds after arriving on the scene, Officer Lohman shot and killed Rice. The boy had been playing with what was later identified as an airsoft pellet gun. A video obtained by the Northeast Ohio Media Group shows Rice's 14-year-old sister running over to her brother, being tackled and forced to the ground, handcuffed, and placed in a patrol car while her brother lay dying. The video also shows that police waited 4 minutes before providing any first aid to Rice. On June 3, 2015, the county sheriff's office released a statement saying their investigation had been completed, with their findings turned over to the county prosecutor. A grand jury later declined to indict Officer Lohman.
When we talk about law enforcement, we talk about 18,000 different police departments in the United States. Most of the departments that I'm familiar with, they don't have specific training for police officers to deal with minors and toy guns. It's mentioned during sometimes roll call, sometimes during the basic academy, that of course there's a possibility. But again, police officers are like any other people. They fear. They have fear. They have more fear probably than an average person because they also see situations that are much more dangerous and horrific than an average person. They're not taught or trained how to control their fears.
You know, Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the Black lives that are the last ones that have value.
Even within our own nation, the consciousness has been raised. People were preaching about color blindness. They realized that there are race issues that are still permeate our society.
I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
There is just as much anger out here.
These police officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard.
This is for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. This is for a better life for IRIB English Radio. I am Sayyid Mahdi Tawakkol, and one of my specialties is in enhancing the style for living. And my talk is based on the Quran and Islamic tradition. In this episode of the program, I will be going over a new subject, which is the role of positive thinking. Our life is made of a mixture of many good or bad events, ups and downs, hope and despair, wealth and poverty, health and illness, and so on and so forth. But if we pay more attention, we will realize that even in the midst of a so-called severe struggle and mental involvement, when we try to cope with a hardship, at the middle of our hardship, God's blessings are much more than that difficulty. This is a fact. If we compare these two with each other, we should take notice. We should think more deeply about those blessings to realize it at the middle of difficulty. We should not be neglectful about those blessings. Let's firstly refer to the Quran to understand this point more, and then I will go on the continuation of this subject. If we have a survey of the verses of chapter Yusuf, we see that Prophet Yusuf faced many sorts of inconvenience in his life. His brothers firstly separated him from his father, put him in the well, and finally sold him as a slave to some people. Then again, the wife of Aziz in Egypt fell in love with him. And because Yusuf did not pay attention, she threw him in prison. Yusuf stayed in the jail for more than 10 years. Then he could find a way to get out of the prison, gained authority in Egypt, and sent for his father and brothers to come to him. When they came to Yusuf, Yusuf started talking to them. When he was talking, he talked emotionally and gently. What he says is full of positive thinking, which is the title of this program. He firstly says, قَدْ أَحْسَنَ بِي إِذْ أَخْرَجَنِي مِنَ السِّجْنِ. My Creator was certainly gracious to me when he brought me out of the prison. As we see, Yusuf does not protest that why God did not prevent him from being put into the prison, but sees the positive side of that event and says, if God's grace did not encompass him, instead of about 14 years that he was into the jail, he might have stayed there much longer and would have been totally forgotten in there. Now, let's have a break and I will come back and continue telling the story of the Prophet Yusuf and his positive attitude.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand there crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Welcome back to the program For a Better Life. I was talking about the positive viewpoint of the Prophet Yusuf. When he was talking with his father and his brothers, just looked at the positive ways of the matter. In the continuation of the verses that I recited, he says to his brothers, "Another mercy of my Creator upon me is that he brought you over from the desert to me after that Satan has incited ill feeling between me and my brothers." Again, Yusuf does not remind his brothers of the oppression they made to him. Instead, he thinks about the mercy of Allah, who finally joined between him and his brothers. The verses of the Quran are not for us just to read, but it is for us to act accordingly and do the same. Another example is found with regard to the Prophet Abraham. This prophet also suffered so much. Firstly, Nimrud, the famous pagan, decided to burn him by fire. Finally, Abraham, by the order of God, settled some of his family in a dry desert near Mecca to establish the rites of Hajj. Here, when Allah talks about Abraham, says something that shows that this great prophet used to think positively. As Allah says, "Shakiran li'an'amihi," Abraham was grateful to Allah, to the blessings of Allah. And because of this, Allah chose him for the position of prophethood and guided him to the straight path. When Allah says that Abraham was shakiran li'an'amihi, means Abraham always used to highlight the mercies of Allah. This is the way of thinking positive. Now again, as I said at the beginning of this program, even in the midst of a problem, the degree of God's blessing is much higher than the hardship. This is a fact. Let me make an example so my talk would be more tangible. Imagine a man who has lost one of his relatives. He is weeping bitterly. At the same time, when the man cries, if he just pays attention to his body, I mean, imagine that he is going to confine his mind just to his body, the mercies that are created in his body. He would see that many parts of his body are working properly. His heart pulsates normally. His digestive organs works. The blood circulates in his body. He can see, he can hear, his mind works, and so on and so forth. Add to it many other blessings like he has a house to rest, a food to eat, oxygen in the air to breathe, and so on. Just among thousands of blessings, just one or more, a few of them are taken away. Why a wise man should disregard these numerous divine bounties and just focuses on some few blessings that he no longer has? We should remember that the only thing in life we can control is ourselves and the way of our thinking. We cannot control every event. We cannot control others. But we can control how we react to our mind, to our body. We can change the way of our attitude. The criterion here is this: in any predicament, we can choose to focus on the negative or on the positive side of the scenario. But if we choose to focus on what is bothering us, it will begin to negatively impact our life. In addition, by this way, we will also attract more negative situations. This is what the law of attraction says. We should not forget that we can empower ourselves. We can improve the way of thinking. We need to tackle any bad situation and start believing that a positive mindset is out there and we can reach it. Positive thinking bypasses the rage and inconvenience. It allows us to enjoy the moment, to be happier in our life. By consciously choosing to focus on positive moments in our life, we will begin to reframe our thoughts. We can gradually cultivate our mind to be open to an abundance of positive thinking. By this way, we will become more thankful to Allah, would not complain, and would not become ingratitude. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share.